Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. Of course, I have to remind everyone that we Zoom on Tuesday, so again, if something should happen on Tuesday night, well, we're not going to be covering it. I do have to tell you, however, that I spent the last couple of hours watching the George Floyd funeral in Houston, Texas. And because my show airs on KPFT, I just need to tell Houston, you have a great mayor. You have a great mayor. He gave an incredible talk. Anyway, we begin our show every single day between now and November with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman when he was testifying before the impeachment hearing of 2019. I always tell people, remember Vindman as you go into the voting booth. Have his words and his assurance to his father that it will be all right in your head, because unless we make change in 2020, it will not be all right. And then I said to people, well, let's remember Wisconsin. And now I'm hearing stories of what's happening in Georgia in their primary election today. And now I have to say, let's remember Georgia. But of course, the testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free, free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
So I'm reading The New Republic, and I went, oh, we haven't talked to Walter Shapiro in a long time. And of course, I've known Walter for, I have to admit this, Walter, for decades, because I've been covering presidential politics. I myself have been a former politician. I describe myself as a politician in recovery, but let me give everyone the skinny on Walter Shapiro. He is a fellow at the Brennan Center and an award-winning journalist. He's a staff writer for The New Republic, a columnist for Roll Call, a frequent contributor to The Guardian, a lecturer in political science at Yale University. He was a White House speechwriter for President Jimmy Carter. And how many presidential campaigns have you covered, Walter?
This, number 11.
There we go. See, I told you.
Every time there was a contested race, I think every one of those 11, I made a trip to New Hampshire.
You did. You absolutely, which is how we got to sort of hang out together, Walter, which is always a pleasure. So your piece at The New Republic was, how do I say this? It was powerful in part because it put together all these little pieces of history that I think are so important. It was entitled The Revolt of the Center Right. Prominent Republicans are balking at voting for Trump. Could it cost him the election? And of course, we watched Mitt Romney masked up talking about Black Lives Matter the other day. And I thought, well, that was shocking until I realized his father did something very similar as well. So in a lot of ways, Romney had to do it because he so admired and honored his dad. And he realized that if there was integrity to the Romney name, he needed to be there too. So let me welcome you to the program, Walter. There is so much for you to write about, but let's start with this one because it's been an interesting week with the generals talking, with finally some senators beginning to talk. The question
is, what was really interesting that happened is the Trump tweet implying that somehow the 75-year-old man who was pushed to the ground in Buffalo and then left to bleed on a pavement was somehow an agent provocateur because we all, you know,
part of Antifa. I think he was reaching out for anything like an octopus.
Disciples of Dorothy Day in the Catholic and the Catholic worker movement are always out there fomenting violence in our communities.
Let me remind everyone, the reason he said that is that he's a Catholic worker. So I just want everyone to know, this isn't just any old 75-year-old.
This is a peace demonstrator, a Catholic activist. Yes. But what after people like Susan Collins courageously responded to a Trump tweet by saying, I really wish the president wouldn't tweet so much.
Oh.
Lisa Murkowski.
Phenomenal.
Said, oh my God, did he really? Ugh.
Well, but Lisa Murkowski said something else, that she won't be intimidated by tweets.
Yep, and so people like that, the Mitt Romney inspired this, the fact that George W. Bush, not exactly every Democrat's favorite historical president, put out a very strong statement in support of the protesters very early in the week. The fact that the Battle of Lafayette Square, which Donald Trump won so courageously by gassing peaceful protesters and then walking with Ivanka as she carried a Bible in her $1,400 white Max Mara pocketbook, and then so he could brandish it in front of an Episcopal church he didn't belong to and didn't enter, had a major effect of prompting Jim Mattis to break his vow of silence, a vow of silence that the Trappist monasteries around the world hitherto would have envied, you know, that it isn't fitting for someone like of a military background to comment on political matters, and to basically say that America has lacked mature leadership for 3 years, to criticize the chairman of the Joint Chiefs for both accompanying Trump and walking around Washington as if he was in the on the beaches of Normandy wearing combat fatigues. The fact that all of these people have suddenly found much more courage to speak out got me thinking about what I dream of as Republican and military night at the Joe Biden convention.
Well, you know, and so you then went back and you sort of looked at some of the sort of people in history who have done something similar.
What is really surprising is there aren't many.
No.
My favorite historical example, in 1992, conservative Georgia Democratic Governor Zell Miller was one of the gave the keynote speech to the 1992 Democratic Convention nominating Bill Clinton, and he attacked the incumbent president, George H.W. Bush. In 2004, Zell Miller, now a conservative Georgia Senator, gave the keynote speech at the Republican convention attacking John Kerry on behalf of George W. Bush. The idea of someone in both attacking and defending a single political family at two different conventions is one of the greatest double-jointed feats in political history. But the fact is, it is actually breathtakingly rare for an elected official to actually take that step and appear at another party's convention.
So
Joe Lieberman did it on behalf of John McCain in 2008.
Right.
But there is no more powerful testimonial. And the whole point about Republicans for Trump, Republicans for Biden, and the anti-Trump Republicans, is this is not going to convince someone who proudly wears a MAGA hat, who watches Fox News 22 hours a day, who's still recovering from chugging bleach because the president suggested it. They're not gonna change their votes. But a testimonial for someone holding political office from the other party can have a real power in convincing, say, a apolitical soccer mom in Maricopa County, right outside of Arizona, to vote for Joe Biden.
Right.
Testimonials like this can convince a really troubled activist Republican who really hates what's happened to his or her party to say, you know, I live in the Michigan suburbs. I can't bring myself to vote for Trump. I'll leave the presidential line blank.
Well, that's what they found out. What was so interesting, I think it was Wisconsin or Michigan, the thousands and thousands of people that showed up to vote in 2016, Walter, but left the presidential line blank. Oh. It was, the number was, I mean, they say it always happens. That's not uncommon. But this was a time where the number was, I think it was like 40,000. It was some incredibly large number. And I'm thinking, so you got them in. They exercised the franchise. And what felt like such an important choice, they walked away.
What happened? I spent Election Day 2016 in a state called New Hampshire. I don't know if you've ever heard of it. In Nottingham, New Hampshire, to be specific, doing my own little mini exit poll at the one polling place in Nottingham. And I remember during the lunch hour, a guy maybe in his 50s, painting clothes. I think he was a painting contractor.
Right.
And I said, I introduced myself, reporter, doing my little exit poll. Who'd you vote for president? He said, well, it's a long story. I said, look, I'm standing out here. It's noon on election day. What do I have to do? I can take a long story. And he said, well, I was going to just vote for Senate and other races because I hated them both. But the more I stared at the ballot, the more I decided I hated Hillary a little more than I hated Trump. So I voted for Trump.
Oh.
I mean, the point is that was the 2016, even though Hillary narrowly carried New Hampshire, that was the 2016 election in miniature. What is really interesting, one of the polling numbers right now, is that if you, for those voters, I think it's 10 or 15%, who have an unfavorable opinion of both Trump and Biden, they are going for Biden by like a 2 to 3 to 1 margin, which is just the reverse.
And what if, let's talk a little bit about this because we, and I said this actually yesterday on the radio show that we did with Hedrick Smith. And I said, what was so interesting about 2016 is the story you're telling me was very familiar. And what we were told was that, I don't know whether it was Gallup or Pew, but that Donald Trump was the most disliked candidate ever in polling history, number one. Number two was Hillary Clinton. She was the second most disliked candidate. And I think what the Democrats see in Joe Biden, and I watched Joe Biden actually give a recorded talk at the funeral for George Floyd. He met with the family yesterday, and they actually made him part of the formal funeral service, even though he wasn't physically there. He did a recorded conversation. You know, for all the things that I'm frustrated with Joe Biden and all the reasons why I didn't choose him as my candidate during the primary, he's just not an offensive guy. He doesn't have even all his negatives when it comes to the crime bill and Anita Hill and everything. I can give you a whole conga line of stuff that makes me apoplectic about him. But when I look at the gestalt, it's not a negative, Walter. It's not a negative. He's kind of a nice Joe, and you kind of understand why Barack Obama really valued that relationship. You get it, and those 8 years of the two of them hanging out, he wasn't more offended by him. He kind of liked him even more.
Yeah, and the whole point is that Joe Biden, and I hate to use this word because it's a political cliche, but I think it applies in Biden's case, is genuine. There's not a lot of artifice there.
Yeah.
And basically, Joe Biden has made a number of political missteps in a 40-plus year
public. He's had lots of opportunity to make mistakes. Let's put
it that. I mean, it's, shall we say, a longer list than many in politics. But the point is, Joe Biden is liked.
Yeah.
And that really makes a difference when you're running against the most hated presidential incumbent in memory.
All right, so let me say something. I mentioned to you that I read your piece, and I remembered the Ronald Reagan line because you reminded me of the Reagan line. So here's what I wrote, and I want to read a comment that was put on my Facebook post. So I wrote, Ronald Reagan said, thank you, Walter Shapiro, for reminding me, I didn't leave the Democratic Party, it left me. What is it going to take Republicans to realize that their party has not left them, rather it has been completely hollowed out, devalued, lacks meaning. It is a party without purpose, unless chaos and destruction is your raison d'etre. And so people have been commenting on it. And then someone wrote the following, you should be asking the same of the Democratic Party. Now, let me tell you what you just said about Joe Biden. Joe Biden has been in politics forever, which is a bad thing. He's been around for what, how many years?
Unless you want a president who knows how to pull the levers in Washington, maybe. In which it's a good thing.
Right, right. But if you look at Joe Biden's political career, it really kind of reflects how the Democratic Party changed. I mean, the Democratic Party in 1991 and 92, when Bill Clinton was running, it suddenly went from the party that was sort of the anti-Reagan party that seemed to be more of the consumer worker party. It suddenly became the more financially sensitive party with Wall Street. So if you look at the time frame of Joe Biden, it really is a reflection of the changing way the Democratic Party has operated. And what you are seeing today is also a Joe Biden that reflects a changing Democratic Party, a Democratic Party that is actually more activist oriented, that is more progressive, that is demanding change. I mean, I'm actually hearing words like revolution and healthcare being a right. And who is it coming out of? Not Bernie Sanders, but Joe Biden. So in a lot of ways, Joe Biden is the perfect character because he is the waxing and waning of the Democratic Party. And you may not like Joe, but Joe is what the party was and now is.
What you also have to understand is we're so used to looking at the Northeast as just a swatch of blue on all political maps.
Yeah.
But Joe Biden was elected to the Senate in 1972.
Yeah, there you go.
Delaware, his state, went Republican for president in 72. They voted for Carter in 76, Reagan in 80, Reagan in 84, George H.W. Bush in 88.
Wow.
So here you have Joe Biden. Many of these votes were cast in a state where the Republicans had won 4 out of 5 presidential elections.
That is such a powerful story.
And so a lot of Biden's caution has to be put in the context of the 70s and 80s.
All right. So, Walter, I'm so glad you taught me this because I did not know that piece of the story. You should write a piece about that. That is just so important. Or maybe you have. But and I apologize because I didn't read it. But let me tell you what I say about Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders has been politically raised in the sort of Finland of America. Okay, Vermont isn't like any of the other 50 states. Vermont really is this oasis of kind of social democratic policies. It is very progressive. He's never had to fight for anything. He's never had any really significant pushback. And so in a lot of ways, he has been liberated to be the progressive liberal revolutionary he's been, because that's really the home in which he has come from, which is the state of Vermont. I know he was born in Brooklyn, but let's understand his politics is in Vermont. You are just describing the politics of Joe Biden, and the politics of Joe Biden has not had that opportunity to sort of be nurtured by a bunch of lefties. Instead, he's had to figure out how to thread the needle where he's in a state where, as you just pointed out, 4 out of 5 times they voted for the Republican for president.
Also, even the 94 crime bill, he was, as chairman of the Judiciary Committee, he was doing the heavy lifting for an incumbent Democratic president who wanted the bill. That what you have to, well, I'm not saying Biden should get off the hook for responsibility, but you have to understand that party loyalty, when there's a Democrat in the White House, causes people to do certain things. And Bill Clinton, was really so scared of the law and order issue. He had come, his one gubernatorial defeat in 1980 was after Jimmy Carter had brought a lot of Cuban prisoners who came over in the Mariel boat lift to a prison in Arkansas. So, I mean, that Bill Clinton was much more afraid of Ronald Reagan than probably reality in hindsight required him to be. But that was why there were so many bad provisions in the crime bill. It isn't like Bill Clinton said, I want a liberal crime bill. And Joe Biden said, no, we're going to make this a tough on crime, pro-police.
It was the opposite. This is so fascinating for me because in 1996, I ran for Congress, Walter. In 1996, I ran against Bill Clinton. I ran against the crime bill and I ran against the welfare reform bill. I mean, and it was so bad that someday I'm gonna show you some of the tapes, but I'm running against an incumbent named Charlie Bass. And Charlie Bass is saying, you see how crazy Arnie is? She is actually running against her own president of the United States. Of course, today I sound like everyone goes, oh, you were so smart, you were so right, all this other stuff. But now you are explaining to me, he was carrying Clinton's water. I couldn't do that. I refuse to do that.
Yeah.
But Biden did. And I always said that Bill Clinton was a Republican wet dream. The Republicans couldn't do what Bill Clinton delivered for them. And Bill
welfare
Clinton not only
reform,
delivered for them.
Budgets.
Yes.
Yes. Crime.
I know, it's incredible. Repeal of Glass-Steagall, the deregulation of derivatives. I mean, when you look at everything Bill Clinton did, Republicans were like, oh my God, and he's not one of us.
Ending welfare as we know it.
Yes, it is shocking. But I think that's really important that you remind everyone about that arc of history of Joe Biden, because that arc of history is going to be different than a lot of other people. And it's not only that it started in 72, it's not only that he was, working with Bill Clinton, who was, the Republican only and, Democrat name only, but then you understand.
That's a little hard on Clinton.
Oh, when I look at what happened under the years of Bill Clinton after 8 years, you have to understand it is exhausting. Because when you look at the growing inequality, when you look at the rise of finance, when you look at the fact that there was so little oversight over financial products, why, as someone said, because when we decided to deregulate derivatives, basically where did all the financial products go? They went through the derivatives hole, and then there was nothing to regulate.
In defense of Clinton.
All right, you can defend him, Walter.
On equality, the best anti-poverty program that has passed Congress in 30 years was the massive expansion of the earned income tax credit under Clinton.
Right, which was, it was started by the man he was so afraid of, as you just mentioned, Ronald Reagan. So what gave Bill Clinton cover to expand the earned income tax credit is that he could genuflect from, St. Ronald in order to do it. I mean, what is Newt Gingrich's raison d'etre all through the 1990s? In every single county in America, there had to be some shrine to Ronald Reagan. I mean, that's absolutely true. Newt Gingrich really wanted to see that. One of the other sort of reactionaries. But you begin to realize that was in part Clinton being able to do something very important. I agree with you. But the way he was able to frame it was that he was able to frame it as an expansion of Ronald Reagan.
But remember again that Democrats were shell-shocked because they lost 3 straight landslide elections.
Right.
80, 84, right. 88. Not close elections, landslide elections.
Right. And let me go back. I mentioned Newt Gingrich. It was Grover Norquist who spent the 19. God, sorry, I apologize about it. I start getting them mixed up after all. It was Grover Norquist.
Grover will be so happy to know that.
Yeah, no. Oh, I mean, there had to be something that sort of celebrated Ronald Reagan in every county in America. To me, it's still remarkable that they would actually do that. Now Ronald Reagan is too lefty for them. He's not even mentioned anymore. It's kind of shocking when you think about it.
But the power of his line, I didn't leave the Democratic Party, it left me, is just a reminder of that any Republican who endorses Biden is doing the Lord's work, because it is such a legitimizer for Biden, for swing voters in the middle.
So you really do see that what Zell Miller did, what Kirkpatrick did, those people that really, you don't have to speak to a lot of people. You have to sort of speak to a very important pivotal voter. And therefore, these people, these Republicans that might actually speak at a Democratic convention aren't important for the base, but they are important for those that are still either undecided or are going to leave it plain.
Right. And let me end by just saying, you know who was one of the leaders of Democrat Republicans for Lyndon Johnson in 1964 against Barry Goldwater?
Who?
Jackie Robinson. Jackie Robinson had been a Nixon supporter in 60.
Wow.
And he was one of the leaders of Republicans for Johnson in 64.
Walter Shapiro, I love you. You have such a mind for detail. You have not forgotten a thing. And all these little pieces of history are so important because they help us better in understanding either the candidate in front of us, the choices that we have, why we need to look at these, you know, voices of Mattis, this walk of Romney, and understand they do have meaning and they could affect change. Walter Shapiro writes for, of course, The New Republic. He's a columnist for Roll Call, a frequent contributor to The Guardian, a lecturer in political science at Yale University, and one of my favorite parts of his resume, he was a speechwriter for Jimmy Carter. Let me remind everyone, go to New Republic and read his piece, The Revolt of the Center-Right. I love you, Walter Shapiro. We have to get you on again.
It's always so much fun.
All right, ciao. Stick around, everyone. We'll be right back.
Good to see you, Walter. Take care.
Bye. I'm Dr. Anthony Lazowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Carbon emissions from power plants, transportation, and industry cause global warming, but reducing that pollution may not be enough to avoid the worst effects of climate change. Some scientists say the world must also remove carbon that's already in the atmosphere. Gianna Amador is co-founder of the nonprofit Carbon 180. She says that a number of industries already have strategies to soak up carbon pollution.
We can farm in ways that store more carbon in the soil. We can plant more trees. And there are also technologies that are basically big fans that use chemical reactions to capture carbon directly from the air and separate that out into a pure stream of CO2 that can then be either sequestered underground or used in products like cements and plastics.
But to meet climate goals, these solutions need to scale up dramatically. To help, Amador's nonprofit has started a fellowship. It helps entrepreneurs launch businesses that, within a decade, can remove 1 billion tons of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere each year.
We think that visionary leaders and entrepreneurs can really have a hand in scaling these carbon removal solutions.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
Well, everybody goes away. Then Moses led, my God,
God's going to trouble the water.
And I now
wait in the water, my children.
Some say Paul,
my God,
well, wait on me.
Welcome back to part two of the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. He writes is it a newsletter? What do you call Big? Because I read it religiously because I think it's incredibly valuable. But in part, the reason why I read it religiously is that your history of politics is so valuable. Therefore, your knowledge in what you write really brings together so many interesting pieces, because at such a young age, you've done a hell of a lot.
Well, yeah, I call it a newsletter because right. I send it out over email, and you know, it's also on the web, so you can get it. So it has it's elements of blogging. It's a little bit like a blog, but it goes out over email. But thank
now,
you.
Are you still a fellow with the Open Markets Program?
No, I'm actually the director of research for the American Economic Liberties Project, which is a different nonprofit. And
when was that formed, and what's the raison d'être for them?
So we formed in January, so we're not that old.
Okay.
Our goal is to, you know, similar to Open Markets. Open Markets focus on the problem of monopoly. We also focus on the problem of monopoly, but where they're more, they do more research, we just do more policy advocacy.
Okay. And so let me give people a little bit of your background, because I knew about Open Markets. Now I know about this new organization that was founded in January. But I want people to know the reason why I'm so impressed with your resume is that you were the senior policy advisor to the Senate Budget Committee, where you focused on trade, competition policy, and financial services. You helped author legislation on the Federal Reserve reform, the concentration of power among banks, and the restructuring of our trading arrangements. In addition to your work on the Hill, you produced for MSNBC and starred in an FX political comedy show with Russell Brand. His writing has appeared in The Atlantic, The New York Times, Vice, Salon, The New Republic, and The Nation. So we go to a wealth of knowledge with Matt Stoller.
Thank you.
It's incredible. The piece you wrote was entitled Corporate Power, Protests, and the Breakdown of a Social Contract. Right. And the part that I sort of jumped out at me when I was going through it was a paragraph that I highlighted. I want to read it because then I want to go back to your piece and you can go through it for my audience. And you wrote this: while bigotry was a widely held cultural attitude, racism is an institutional phenomenon that was buried in every nook and cranny of the American order. It was not just police violence, Jim Crow laws, or the subtext of vigilante racial terrorism, though those were the most obvious signposts. There were serious disparities in healthcare treatment, access to capital, auto insurance, business insurance, patent law, hiring decisions, housing, media ownership, transportation, education, and nutrition options, not to mention the endless number of opportunities closed off because of segregated social networks. And as I read that paragraph, all of a sudden, the title of your piece, Corporate Power, Protests, and the Breakdown of a Social Contract, it just made so much sense. So walk us through how your piece evolves.
Yeah, so the thesis of the piece is that America had really, in the 20th century, well, really starting in the 30s, had three basic social contracts. One is, you know, really starting in the 1930s, but manifests most obviously after the Second World War. You have the New Deal social contract, in which you have broadening economic power to a white middle class. And that happened because we displaced the robber barons and were able to get rid of their power through a range of banking laws and anti-monopoly rules. And then that laid the basis for this, you know, this suburbia and the white middle class. And then it also laid the foundation for the civil rights movement, for feminism, for gay rights, which were all ways of saying that we need to broaden the definition of citizenship, of who gets access to this middle class lifestyle of political and economic empowerment. And that lasted until about the 1970s. In that period, you know, there was a lot of racial discrimination. It was buried institutionally. There was also a lot of bigotry. To give you a sense of how that's changed, in 1958, just 4% of the country supported or found acceptable interracial marriage between blacks and whites. It's now you know, just a couple of years ago, it was 87%. Now it's probably 95%.
Right.
But it was still not a majority in the 1990s. So this is not that, it's not like a change in the 1970s. We've, as a culture, we're much less bigoted. And you can see that in a lot of different social metrics. But institutionally, the racism is still buried in our institutional fabric, which is kind of what you're seeing right now. Okay, but the second social contract, which, you know, that lasts until the 1970s, and income growth for blacks is actually twice as fast as it is for whites from the 1940s until the 1970s.
Wow.
So the gap closes. The gap in lifespans closes. There's a bunch of social gaps that close. They don't close entirely, but they close. Then in the 1970s, really late 1970s, starting around 1979, 1980, and then the election of Reagan, you see a second social contract. So the basis of the first social contract is a job, with some healthcare, with some benefits, some stability, so often unionized or white collar, and a home, which is a forced savings vehicle, but also the bedrock of a neighborhood and an educational system. Starting in 1980, you lose a lot of the unionization benefits. You lose a lot of the income growth raises, but you know, you substitute for that credit, right? So people draw down their savings, they take on more debt, so they can still consume as much or more, but they're borrowing now. And the home becomes less an anchor of community and more a financial asset. That's the Reagan era social contract, which is a lower trust social contract. That's when the institutions start moving away from, they were anti-racist for that period of the 1940s to the 1970s, which is why you saw income growth that was twice as high for African Americans as it was for whites. They weren't all anti-racist, but broadly speaking, that they were pushing the country in a certain direction. In the 1980s, this flips. So even as the country's getting more culturally tolerant, people are becoming less bigoted, still bigoted, but they're less bigoted. The institutional changes push people, push racial inequities. Then the third social contract starts in 2007, 2008, when housing, which is the basis for both social contracts or a key element of both social contracts, the home ownership model, that snaps, that ends. The foreclosure crisis, the mortgage crisis, that just ends the way that elites through the Fed and through our banking system connect to the middle class or the working class, which is through home ownership. That's why, you know, you can see it in the financial system, the interest rates are at zero, right? And they've been basically at zero since 2008. That's really weird. And that's not the way that the first two social contracts related. And that's because the link, the monetary transmission mechanism between the elites and everyone else through their homes is broken. Now, we're in this period where people don't, you know, part of the both social contracts was, you know, this is William Levitt, who I quoted, and I love this quote. William Levitt created the first kind of post-war modern suburb.
And Levittown, Long Island.
There we go. No man who owns his own home and lot can be a communist because he has too much to do. And there are a lot of ways to read that. But one of the ways to read it is that if you have a stake in society, you're going to protect that society. And if you don't have a stake in that society, you're going to become politically radical. There are lots of different ways to be radical, but that's essentially giving people a stake in society through home ownership is a way to anchor and stabilize an order. And so when you pull that property ownership, that small bits of property that a lot of people own away from them, as we did in the foreclosure crisis and then in policies ever since, what you do is you destabilize the society. It's not just William Levitt, who's kind of a bad guy, but like William Findlay, who is a populist Revolutionary War era congressman, anti-corruption guy, he said, wealth in many hands is many checks, right? The idea of broad property ownership dispersal as a check against corruption, as a stabilizing feature of democratic societies. So now we're in this weird moment, right? Since 2008, where you see constant swings back and forth politically. You've seen change elections pretty much every year since 2006, except 2012. That was the only year it wasn't a change election. You see Trump, who's a weird anomaly, likely gonna see another change election in 2020. So, and this is all of, you see lots of protests, which we didn't see for a long time. What you're seeing now is a broad revulsion at how our culture is being organized. And we're either going to move towards a society where you once again have broad property ownership, so people have a stake in society so that they don't rebel. And what we're seeing is rebellion in various forms, not all of which are great, but that's just what you see. Or you're going to move towards a different model, which is a much more authoritarian model, where people don't have a stake in society, but they're kind of brutalized by security forces who coddle a kind of and protect a narrow elite. What you see in a lot of kind of more authoritarian societies, often in kind of Latin America and various other places. But those are the two options in terms of how we reorganize a social contract.
So here's my concern. We are taping a show on Tuesday. I am looking at tweets coming in from Georgia, and I'm realizing that the Georgia elections are a disaster. Okay, equipment's not working. It was sent to wrong places. People are waiting 4 hours. Claire McCaskill tweeted something out. She was like apoplectic about what's going on. And so I'm looking at this, and you're talking about these two choices. Well, the authoritarian choice wants to make sure that you undermine the election, wants to make sure you don't trust the results, wants to make sure you don't leave office. So I am wondering whether we still have a political system, an ability to exercise the franchise, a way to create a result in November that not only produces trust, but allows people to have a stake in the outcome. Because if you're telling people that there is no way to trust this election, then where do they go to make change, Matt?
Well, I mean, I think that you have, you know, you see increasing instability in even when you do have elections. So yeah. It's not like, you know, we had an election in 2016 that I think was, most people believe that Trump was legitimately elected. You know, he won that election. I mean, certainly there were popular vote disparities, but people don't think that the machines were rigged. And you certainly saw the Democrats win the election in 2018. And yet I think you're seeing a lot of social discord regardless. So it's not just an electoral issue. I mean, obviously if you have an election in 2020, which is disputed, it's probably, you know, it's unlikely to be a kind of a good thing for social stability. But, you know, we had a really disputed election in 1876 that was stolen. And one of the responses and the end of Reconstruction, I mean, it was kind of a deal, like a political deal. What typically happens in these kinds of situations is that you have elites that are in really bitter factional disputes. I mean, ultimately and they just kind of come together and kind of cut a deal, or they just go to war, right? Those are the two options. And I think that what you have right now is, you know, is you have like, you know, a kind of a pre-war situation. And this can, we can either, you know, the great thing about democracies, I mean, what they really do well is that they allow you to avoid social conflict through war, and they mediate it through peaceful mechanisms, AKA right. elections. Right. And so we have a choice as a society about whether we want to continue to do that. And
I want to go back to something you said, though. You talked about the fact that the elites are at war, and they right. have to figure out how to sort of, so are we pawns in this game? I mean, are the elites ultimately going to figure out which side wins? Are they going to make a compromise, and I get to sort of follow their compromise? So how is this going to work? I want to go back to your point about Leavitt, you know, that we all have to have a home. We all have an investment. We all have some ownership. Well, the elites are making sure that all the ownership is with them. All the wealth is with them. All the control is with them. So does voting have meaning?
It does. I mean, so it still does, right? I mean, I think one of the things that you see, though, is a tremendous fear, particularly on the Democratic Party side of governing. So one of the things that the key choice that, you know, the Democrats made and the Republicans made in March was to empower the Federal Reserve to basically organize the entire economic response to the pandemic. And you had some portion that went through the Small Business Administration called the Paycheck Protection Program, which was very important. But by and large, the investor class was bailed out through the Fed, junk bonds, private equity, you know, the stock record levels. So, you know, that was a function, and that was a 96-0 vote in the Senate, right? So this is not, and I mean, I'm talking Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren voted for it.
Yeah, I hear you.
And you know, I was watching this, my nonprofit, ALP, we were like, hey, don't vote for this. It's a bad idea. No progressive nonprofits except us said, hey, this is a bad idea.
Why is it a bad idea? So I want, now that you tell me 96 to zip, now that you tell me that it was like kumbaya, including Bernie and Elizabeth.
Right.
What, if this is a bad idea, what would have been a better idea? What would have been the, what would be the choice that you would have supported, Matt?
Well, I mean, the thing is that generally speaking, dueling 1,000-page bills are a problem. What would have been really simple is to say, we're going to pass an unemployment insurance bill, right? And it's going to be 3 pages. It's going to take care of people who are unemployed and pass that. Then we're going to deal with small businesses and we're going to pass a bill to deal with that. Then we're going to do a bill to deal with, you know, states and cities. Then we're going to do a bill to deal with free coronavirus testing. All of these bills could have been 3 or 4 pages. They would have been really easy to understand. You didn't need to jam everything into a 1,000-page bill, cut a giant deal. The reason they were doing that, or you could have passed the 1,000-page bill and just pulled the Fed bailout piece out and dealt with that.
So why did they support the Fed bill? Is it because it was woven into this 1,000 pages? Therefore, in order for them to get what they wanted, which was, you know, unemployment insurance, whatever it was, bailout hospitals, that they had to hold their nose and vote for the Fed bailout? Or was the Fed bailout understood as also pivotal in not just getting this passed, but that you had to deal with the sort of corporate investment class?
No, I mean, it's a deep-seated fear and laziness on the part of Democrats and progressives. So take the hospital bailouts, right? One of the things the Democrats demanded was they said, we need to get money for hospitals in return for these other things, right? Mm-hmm. And so they put $100 billion or whatever it was into hospitals. And people just hear, oh, hospitals, I want them to have money. Well, guess what the deal is with hospitals? They're corporate monopolies. Yeah. And so a bunch of them took this money, paid their executives tens of millions of dollars, and laid a bunch of people off.
I know.
So, you know, Bernie and Warren are fundamentally, we're not willing to point out that it's not just big pharma and insurance companies that are screwing people, it's hospitals. And it's because actually that requires explaining something, and they just prefer to pander. And I think generally speaking, you have this embarrassing lack of knowledge and curiosity on the part of the Democrats and progressives as in the institutional details of how our government and how our businesses work. I deal a lot with Republicans, and Republicans are arsonists. They're really just burn things down. I don't want Republicans to be in charge. But the thing about Republicans is they're like, let me have a hand over that state so I can govern. And they really drill into the details so that they can build their wall or so that they can, you know, do the things that they want to do. Whereas Democrats are just incredibly lazy and superficial. And it's
well, come on. The Republicans lie to us about what they're going to do, right? Of course they do.
But they also actually pay attention to the levers and details of power. Like Eugene Scalia is at the Department of Labor.
Oh, I know.
Loopholes for private equity so they can get their hands on our 401k. We, by contrast, had Tom Perez, who's a moron, at the Department of Labor doing whatever, you know, UBS wanted. And it's like, and then he would just promise to do some mild thing on overtime. And it's like, the Department of Labor has massive power over multi-trillion-dollar capital markets. So it's like, there is a deep-seated ideological problem in the progressive space and on the Democratic side where they just don't think about power. They don't care about it. They're not interested in it. And so when it comes time to something like the CARES Act, where you have two popular candidates for president, who by then were out of the race, Bernie and Warren, but were popular, they both essentially rocketed to stardom because of the financial crisis and because of corruption on Wall Street or because they wanted an expansion of public health care. In the biggest financial crisis and biggest public health crisis of our lifetimes, they had zero policy impact, zero, just none. And it's like, I watch the progressives not care and not pay attention. And we haven't reckoned with that. And I think part of the problem here is that people don't admit that this happened. They just pretend it didn't happen. And that's just like, how do you fix the problem unless you admit it?
So Matt, to say that the progressives in Congress are too lazy to get their act together or not skilled enough, you know, they don't have votes. They don't even have the votes of their fellow
voices.
Democrats, much less support among their constituencies. So
let me tell you a quick story, which I think was just like when it happened, I was like, oh yeah, I worked in Congress. I remember this. So there was a big fight over PAYGO, which is a balanced budget rule. And it's just like kind of complicated. But like it doesn't really matter. It's just that it constrains progressives from being able to spend money on things they care about. And it's,
yeah, if they ever enact a social program, they've got to pay for it by reducing.
We know PAYGO.
So, okay, you guys know it. So there are some progressives that were leading a fight against PAYGO, and then there were other progressives that were sort of bargaining around it. And I was doing some reporting to try to figure out the deal because I couldn't figure out exactly what happened. At a certain point, I figured out that one of the progressives had really fed up on the negotiations. I called my friend who was working for these progressives. And I was like, hey, what happened here? He's like, oh, you figured it out. What happened is that they had written, he's like, we wrote a one-page memo explaining what PAYGO is and what the discussion was about. And we've been trying to get him to read it for 3 weeks, and he won't read it. So though he effed up the negotiation because he literally would not read a one-page memo on PAYGO.
Oh my God.
So when I say lazy, like, yeah, they don't have the votes, but like, it's not just that. You know, what they want to do is they just want to be friends with everyone instead of actually understanding the policies. They believe that being friends is important instead of recognizing that you can be friends with someone and you can be firm on what you care about. And if you're just firm, if you're just like, this is what I think, and we're just going to disagree, nobody will hold that against you. But if you don't put your position out and you're just like, hey man, we're friends, everybody thinks you're hard to deal with.
Okay, I'm in total 100% agreement. I remember fighting people about the big ag bills, you know, and everyone had this idea of a farmer driving a farm all. And I'm going, no, honey, it's called Cargill. It's called Monsanto. I mean, probably the largest corporation in the world is a privately held company called Cargill. They're not farmers. They're not farmers. Get with the program, you know? But who gets it? Who's curious enough? Is it Katie Porter? Will she be the person who can begin to start speaking these kinds of truths, asking these kinds of difficult questions, raising up the reason why detail matters? Detail matters. You can't just say hospital and everyone's going to think, oh, of course we need to save them. And then you look at the CEOs bailing themselves out and as you point out, getting rid of nurses. That's not the point. The CEO doesn't take care of me. It's the nurse that cleans my tush.
Yeah, I think that's, like, I like Katie Porter a lot. I think she's...
I do too.
I think Pramila Jayapal is really smart. I mean, there are some smart members. David Cicilline doing some interesting things on
Rhode Island.
Really smart. I think you've got, you know, there are definitely some, I think Chuy Garcia has a lot of insight. And I, you know, you find...
Ro Khanna?
Ro Khanna is really smart, yeah. You see a number of different members who have capacity, and part of it is just like, it's kind of like they have to get together and decide they want to govern. And, you know, you right now you kind of, we're kind of missing an intellectual engine that's attached to policymakers, that's attached to regulators. That's kind of like the neoconservatives. What they did is they had a bunch of members and they had a bunch of thinkers and they had a bunch of people in policy making positions and they had a bunch of people in business and they were all networked and they all cooperated to move a shared agenda forward. It was a bad agenda, but that's what they cooperated on. You don't have that on the progressive space. It's just a bunch of people that don't really collaborate. So pulling that together is not impossible. It's just that, right, you know, and that's kind of what we're trying to do in my organization, but it's just like, we've got to do that. We have to actually start to build and operationalize a real actual movement.
So what you just described with the hospitals, I'm aware of, okay? And because of the pandemic, because of the hospital, because healthcare has taken on a new life of its own, is this the opportunity to use this as a teaching tool, to use this as a way for them to explain the detail? Since, you know, it's not like I don't want to bail out a hospital, but if I'm going to bail out a CEO over my dead body, and therefore you're beginning to put some kind of limits on what's being done. It's not this black hole where money goes in because they like the title. They just don't want to look at the rest of the bill.
Part of it, I agree with that. I mean, it's always an opportunity, right? You can always make positive policy change. And, you know, I have, you know, it's just that the question, like, part of what's going on here is like, we have to be able to get people who care about social justice questions to recognize that a lot of the social justice questions are handled on spreadsheets and in the corporate world. So as an example for hospitals, right, I did a back of the envelope calculation. Like, let's say you care about racial justice, which I think all of us do. because of insulin price increases from 2011 to 2016 and disproportionate share of African Americans that have diabetes, African Americans pay about between $10 and $15 billion more per year, every year, because of that price appreciation in insulin markets. And it's pure cartel behavior. That's just that's just sucking wealth from the Black community into the hands of executives. Now, go to hospitals for a second. One of the things that happens with African Americans and diabetes in Southern hospitals that are owned by chains and private equity, they do a disproportionately high share of amputations. So what you're seeing is that, and this is obviously a racial justice question. If you're just amputating, Black people with diabetes, and it's attached to a specific regulatory model, we need to start thinking about how corporate power, that's sucking wealth, but it's also just crippling people. You need to start thinking about how the boardrooms and the spreadsheets in the boardrooms and the market structures actually create and reinforce institutional racism, which is different than bigotry, because you don't need a racist
doctor. That's why that paragraph jumped out at me. You're absolutely right.
You don't need a racist doctor to amputate somebody's limb who has diabetes.
Oh, they're saving his life. They're saving his life.
Right. Well, you don't need a racist pharmacist to overcharge someone or to give someone high-priced insulin, right? This is not an issue of bigotry. This is an issue of institutional racism, which is also a question of corporate power. And it hits everyone. This isn't just it just hits Black people worse because Black people have less power. And corporate power is about power. And they prey on people with less power. They prey on everyone, but the more they prey on.
I keep thinking actions have consequences. Actions have consequences. And what you're doing is you're going back and back and back. And so what was the initial point, and why are we amputating? And it's almost like you want to do the photo shoot, and each panel gives you an idea of where you started and where you ended with, the loss of a foot. And when people begin to see it that way, they need it visually. You know that, and I know that. You also know that the way adults learn, and frankly, the way legislators learn, is through repetition. But nobody's ever repeated this, Matt. And I'm just trying to figure out, is this the moment where people are maybe more ready to hear, maybe more ready to be taught, or maybe more ready to understand that details matter? That details matter. If you don't understand the details, you're going to have the worst consequence.
God is in the details. I don't know, but I hope so.
Matt Stoller, you've got to join me more often. Corporate Power, Protests, and the Breakdown of a Social Contract, How the Protests and Riots of 2020 Reflect a Lack of Legitimacy in Our Economic and Political Institutions. Thank you so much. Subscribe to BIG. What's the name of the new organization you're working with starting in January?
So first of all, I have a book, Goliath, The 100-Year War Between Monopoly Power and Democracy. It's a great book. And then the new organization is called the American Economic Liberties Project.
Thank you so much for joining us. I truly appreciate it.
All right. Thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
All right, ciao. Hi, this is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. We'll schmooze tomorrow. Ciao.
Paul and Silas, bound in jail, had no money but to go their bail. Keep your eyes on the prize. Hold on. Hold on.
Hold on.
Hold on. Keep your eyes on the prize. Hold on. Hold on.